The air inside the white Toyota Land Cruiser is thick, stifling, really. It's the smell of 1,000 rose petals starting to wilt in the afternoon heat, mixed with the sharp, metallic tang of diesel exhaust. You're sitting there, and the sound is what hits you first. It's not just noise, it's a physical force. Thousands of voices, rhythmic and guttural, chanting a name that sounds like a prayer and a battle cry all at once. G.A. Bhutto. Long live Bhutto. You look at her. She's sitting right there. She's wearing a deep blue tunic, a white headscarf pinned perfectly, her eyes tired but electrified. She's been told not to do this. The intelligence reports on her desk are explicit. Sniper teams, suicide vests, names of men who have sworn to see her heart stop beating before the sun sets. But the crowd is pressing against the glass. They are reaching for her like she's the only thing keeping them from drowning. She looks at the sunroof. Her advisors are shaking their heads. "Stay down," they whisper. "The glass is armored. You're safe as long as you stay down." She looks at the people, the faces of the poor, the workers, the women who see their own freedom in her eyes. She can't lead them from behind a sheet of reinforced plastic. She stands up. The top half of her body emerges into the open air of Rawalpindi. She's smiling. She's waving. Then, through the roar of the crowd, three distinct sounds. Pop, 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 rewind daily. I'm Marcus Webb, historian and storyteller. December 27, 2007. Today, we're standing on a dusty road in Pakistan, but the ground beneath us feels like it's made of glass. It's a day that didn't just change a country, it broke a specific kind of hope, and it forces us to ask a question that most of us are too afraid to answer in our own lives. If you knew, with absolute certainty, that your next step would be your last, would you still take it? To understand why Benazir Bhutto stood up in that SUV, we have to go back. Not years, but just a few months. Imagine being in exile. You're living in Dubai. In London, you're safe. You're wealthy. You have your children. But your country is screaming. Pakistan in 2007 is a pressure cooker. A military dictator is clinging to power, extremists are gaining ground in the valleys, and the people are hungry for something, anything, that looks like democracy. Benazir is the daughter of the East. Her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was the prime minister until he was marched to the gallows by a general. She watched him die. She spent years in solitary confinement in a desert cell where the heat reached 120 degrees, and the wind blew dust through the bars until her lungs felt like they were filled with crushed glass. She's already been prime minister twice. She's been dismissed, accused of corruption, chased out. But in October 2007, she decides to go back. Her plane touches down in Karachi, and the scene is biblical. Hundreds of thousands of people. A sea of red, black, and green flags. She's weeping as she steps onto the tarmac. But that night, as her motorcade crawls through the masses, two explosions rip through the crowd. 149 people are blown to pieces. The ground is covered in sandals and shrapnel. Benazir survives, ducking into the armored core of her bus just seconds before the blast. Now, think about that. Most people would get back on the plane. Most people would say, "I tried," but she doesn't. She stays. She spends the next 2 months under house arrest, surrounded by barbed wire or rushing from rally to rally. She's a ghost haunting her own life. Every morning, she wakes up and puts on that white scarf, knowing she is a walking target. By the time we get to December 27th, the tension is vibrating in the air. It's a Thursday. She's in Rawalpindi, a garrison city. It's the heart of the military establishment that hates her. She's just finished a speech at Liaquat Bagh, a park that has a dark history. It's the same place where the country's first prime minister was assassinated decades earlier. She's energized. The speech was a triumph. She told the crowd, "I put my life in peril and came here because I feel this country is in danger." She's not being poetic. She knows. As she leaves the stage, she gets into that white Land Cruiser. The crowd is manic. They're drumming on the sides of the car. It's a cacophony of devotion. She could stay in the back seat. She could look through the tinted windows. But Benazir was always a creature of the light. She stands up through the sunroof to acknowledge them. "Let's slow this down. It's 5:14 p.m. The sun is low, casting long, jagged shadows across the road. Benazir is standing. Her head is just above the roofline. A young man, barely more than 20, is standing just a few feet away. He's wearing a jacket and a checkered scarf. In his pocket is a pistol. Under his jacket is a vest packed with ball bearings and C4. He steps forward. He doesn't shout. He doesn't look like a monster. He looks like a student. He raises the gun. Three shots. The first misses. The second clips a bystander. The third strikes the side of her head, or perhaps the force of the blast that follows throws her against the lip of the sunroof, because a fraction of a second later, the boy pulls the trigger on his own life. The explosion is a white flash that swallows the world. The Land Cruiser rocks on its suspension. The windows don't shatter, they're armored, but the pressure wave is immense. Inside the car, it's suddenly quiet. The chanting has stopped. There is only the sound of blood dripping onto the leather upholstery. Then Azir falls back into the seat. Her head is in the lap of her advisor. Her white scarf is gone. Her eyes are open, but the daughter of the East isn't there anymore. The driver screams. He floors it, trying to get to the hospital, but the tires are shredded. They're driving on metal rims, sparks flying, screaming through the dust of the explosion. At the hospital, the doctors try. They massage her heart. They pump air into her lungs. But you can't revive a dream that's been physically torn apart. At 6:16 p.m., a man walks out of the emergency room. He doesn't have to say anything. He just bows his head. Outside, the silence of the shock breaks into a howl of rage. People begin to burn things. They burn cars. They burn shops. They burn the flags of the government. They aren't just mourning a politician. They're mourning the version of themselves they thought she could bring into existence. But here's the complexity. Benazir Bhutto wasn't a saint. Her time in power was marked by accusations of massive graft. Her husband was nicknamed Mr. God, 10%. She was a feudal landlord in a country of peasants. Critics will tell you she was a power-hungry dynast who used the language of democracy to reclaim her family's throne. And they might be right. But that evening, as the smoke rose over Rawalpindi, none of that mattered. What mattered was the vacuum she left behind. When you kill a leader like that, you don't just remove a person. You remove the middle ground. You leave only the extremes. The aftermath was a blur of chaos. The government tried to say she died because she hit her head on the sunroof lever. They hosed down the crime scene within an hour. Literally, fire trucks came and washed the blood and the evidence into the gutters. They didn't want the truth. They wanted the mess gone. But you can't wash away a moment like that. Why does this matter to you right now on a December 27th, years later? Because we live in a world that is increasingly loud and increasingly divided. We often think that change happens through systems, through laws, through grand movements. But history is often just the story of individuals who refuse to stay in the back of the car. Benazir Bhutto knew she was going to die. She had written a letter to her friend, the American lobbyist Mark Siegel, saying that if she were killed, the blood would be on the hands of the dictator, Musharraf. She had told her children how to handle her funeral. She walked into that park knowing the gun was waiting. We like to think we'd be brave in the face of history. But would we? Would you stand up? Or would you stay behind the armored glass? There is a specific kind of courage that looks like madness to the rest of us. It's the courage of the person who decides that their life is less important than their symbol. Benazir chose to be a symbol. And symbols are bulletproof, even when the people carrying them are not. Before I go, there's one detail from that day that haunts the edges of the story. In the wreckage of the car, among the rose petals and the glass, they found her handbag. Inside, there was a small, handheld mirror and a lipstick. Even in the face of the apocalypse, she was preparing to look the world in the eye. She was preparing to be seen. Tomorrow, we're going from the heat of Pakistan to the frozen silence of a Swedish forest, where a different kind of miracle was waiting in the snow. I'm Marcus Webb. This was Rewind Daily. See you tomorrow.